This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hi, I'm Mike Crawley in St. John, New Brunswick. Welcome to the Maritimes This Week. This is a podcast featuring some of the best CBC Radio 1 programming from Prince Edward Island, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick. This week, some amazing personal stories. The snowplow driver in Moncton, who saved a woman's life and lost nearly $1,000 in the process. The former food bank user in St. John, who is now a food bank volunteer. And a grade 11 student, frightened by multiple brawls in a Cole Harbour, Nova Scotia high school. You'll also hear about how easy it is for children to buy lottery tickets on Prince Edward Island. Rob McLaughlin is a snowplow driver who recently moved to Moncton from Toronto. He went to the Boston Pizza restaurant in Moncton, ordered some pizza and ribs, and then he told CBC reporter Vanessa Blanche what happened next.
Well, what happened was I had just finished my training with, I work for the company called MRDC, we're the private company that does the roads, and I had finished a week's worth of training, and on the Saturday morning, I decided I was going to treat ourselves to some Boston pizza and some ribs because we're used to having it. And I came up to the store here on Mountain Road, and I came out of the side of the building and went to go around to the side of the minivan, and it was blocked, so I had to go around another way to the vehicle. And as I was walking around the side of the vehicle, I noticed a lady. She was slumped over the passenger side of the van she was in, and her face was pushed up against the side of the window, and her glasses were off, and she just didn't look right. It was a situation that you could tell it wasn't supposed to be happening. So I was kind of blocked in a way, so I scooted myself sideways towards her window, and I opened the door a bit, and she slumped out. So I pushed the door shut on the passenger side, ran around to the driver's side, got into the vehicle. I don't know if she was breathing or what, but she was turning a different tinge of the color she was supposed to be. So I shook her a bit and she didn't come to. So when I started to pull her, I guess it would be her left-hand side, I noticed on her hand that she had a bracelet. It was a medic alert bracelet. And I knew right away that she had a medical condition. So when I looked at it, it showed that she was diabetic. And it's really strange because my wife is diabetic and my wife told me always to look for those signs. I went into her purse. She had the, I think it's called an Accumeter. I pricked her finger and the blood came out, and it gives you a reading. And so by getting the reading, I knew right away that she was hypoglycemic, which means she's low, which means she needs something in her system. It was really weird because in her purse, she already had the needles preloaded that said hypo and hyper. Now, normally if you weren't diabetic or if you didn't know anything about diabetic, you would have went into a bit of a panic. So I thought, okay, I'll just stay calm. So I went through the steps that my wife Penny told me what to do, took her jacket off on the side of her arm and had her skin exposed. Now, when you give a needle, you got to be very tricky. You don't put it into the muscle. You got to put it right into the skin, underneath the skin. So I gave her needle right away. And within about 30 seconds to a minute, her color started to come back. You could see that she was starting to come to. And then it was like she took a big gasp of breath. Like, so I would think that she was on her last legs, if nothing else. She was probably going into a diabetic coma state if she wasn't in it already.
So what did she say to you when she woke up?
In a case like that, they start babbling and they start to be incoherent. So you really can't say what's going on. So I just told her everything was okay. Everything is fine. You know, help is here. And then what happened is, there was a bunch of people that came out of the restaurant and must have been who she was with, because they all gathered around her vehicle and I said, basically, get back. You know, this lady, she needed some help. So the lady said, well, we're with these people. Apparently what happened was they were up from the United States, from Florida, visiting her brothers and sisters in Moncton. So either they had went in to get some pizza or they had some pizza and she must have came out because she was an older lady and to let her sit in the vehicle. So when she came to and I explained what happened, they had explained to me that, you know, she's diabetic, and it was basically one of these things, if you wouldn't have given her the needle and got her going, she probably would have died because she's has other medications too that she takes, so she's got a whole list of other medical ailments, unfortunately, that she's saddled with. And so I never said really anything about this to anything. When I went home, I told my wife what happened. I didn't tell anybody because I just kind of figured, you know, it was the right thing to do. And then what happened was, on the Tuesday, my boss at MRDC, Roger Cormier, called me up and asked me what happened on the weekend. And I said, well, not too much. Nothing really happened. And he goes, how was your pizza? And I said, oh, you know. He goes, yes, you probably saved the lady's life. It was either the son-in-law or the son called the province of New Brunswick transportation department to the minister's office. And he talked to the minister's office about this. But the funny part was, I never said anything of who I was. I never let on who I was at all. But I had an envelope in my pocket that said my name with MRDC on it and our address on it. And I had some money in there to go pay bills. And I must have dropped it inside the vehicle. So I left the envelope with the money in there. And that's how they found out. So when my bosses were talking to me, I had said to them, well, can you do me a favor? Ask them how the pizza and the ribs were and the chicken wings.
because what happened?
Because I left them in the vehicle. I left them in the vehicle. So I left my money and the pizza and that in the vehicle. But I thought, you know what? The main thing is she's alive. She gets now to see her son-in-law or her daughter or grandsons at Christmas. And the main thing is it turned out good. She's safe.
How much money was in there?
There was actually $971. I had put $971 in the envelope, and I was just going to take that up to the bank and pay some bills. And that's the only reason the people found out who I was because of the envelope. It must have dropped out of my pocket.
And what about the money, though? You haven't gotten the money back?
No, I haven't got any of it back. But it's one of these things, you know what? It might come back. It might not ever come back. But you know what? That's what happens in life sometimes.
Rob McLaughlin speaking to CBC reporter Vanessa Blanche. An additional note to that story. Rob's bosses at MRDC are planning some good things to thank him for his good deed, and the folks at Boston Pizza have donated some gift certificates worth twice the amount of his pizza and rib order. Here's another story about food and about generosity. Food banks have become a permanent part of the landscape here in the Maritimes. The number of people who use their services is remaining steady in much of the region. Some food bank users, however, have found the jobs that mean they no longer have to rely on the food banks. Yet a few of them keep coming back, but this time as volunteers. CBC reporter Sarah Trainer has the story of a woman from St. John who's doing that very thing. She asked that her name not be used. She has family in the city, including a child in high school, and she wanted their identities protected.
It was about 17 years ago, and I was married, and my husband had a very bad gambling problem. And I was working, but there was not more money going out of the house. There was not enough money coming into the house. And I was walking by the food bank one day. I had my baby out in the carriage, and I saw that they were open. And so I stopped in, and I asked if they had any baby formula. And that was very hard.
Why was it hard to ask?
Well, because I have a lot of pride. It would be hard for anybody to ask. People don't want to admit that, you know, that they're there, that people have to use them, but they're there. You know, people don't get paid enough money. You know, I'm sure a lot of the people using the food bank are, you know, you have a lot of working poor people too. They're not just people, you know, they're not just street people or, you know, they're, you know, single parents or working parents who just can't make ends meet. You know, when you have a choice of paying your heating bill or buying groceries.
Can you talk about just maybe when you realized that you were coming into financial difficulties?
I was working, but there just wasn't any money. because the money that I was making wasn't paying the rent and paying the bills and paying everything. I remember waking up, getting up one morning, and the baby was about 2 months old, and I was just, I was so depressed, and I didn't know what was wrong. And he was working full time, and I didn't know why there wasn't any money. It's not fun, you know, opening your cupboards and there's nothing there.
What sort of help did you need, or what did they bring you that you had needed?
Food, groceries, friendship. At Christmas, they brought me things for the baby. They were just, you know, treated me really, really well. We just became very close. They just treated me so well. And then I had an accident at work. I was quite sick. I wasn't able to work. And the others, they were there for me. They knew that I needed help, and they were there for me. And I got a pension from my job. So I'm doing great. My children are grown, and I just bought a house, and I'm doing great. I guess I didn't need to use the services anymore, but I still, you know, volunteer there and help out whenever I can. I would help out usually on Fridays, and I would do some computer work or, you know, go in, and it was a social thing too, because, you know, we had the Friday girls, we had a lot of fun.
So in what way did you volunteer?
Well, I filled up a lot of jars of peanut butter. We'd get these big tubs of peanut butter, great big tubs of peanut butter, and you had to put them in the little margarine jars. I filled up millions. Then I was going to school and taking different computer courses, so I put together a new pamphlet for them. I just continued to help. I mean, you know, somebody helps you so much, you want to give back.
How much did that mean to you to have that help at that time, to have something like the food bank there?
It meant the world. It meant the world to me.
Do you feel like going through that hardship has impacted you?
Made me a better person. I just like volunteering. I just like helping other people. You know, it's extremely tough, especially, you know, for single mothers with, you know, young children or a few children, you know, because they want their children to have just as much as any other child has. And, you know, it's not their fault that most of them, it's not their fault that they're where they're at. And they really just want the best for their children.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you.
CBC News reporter Sarah Trainer was speaking with a St. John woman who's now volunteering at food banks. She asked that her name not be used to protect the identity of her children and her family. You're listening to The Maritimes This Week, a podcast brought to you from CBC Radio in New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and Prince Edward Island. Coming up, an investigation by CBC Radio on PEI reveals that many store owners are all too willing to break the rules and sell lottery tickets to children. But first, it's over to Cole Harbour, Nova Scotia, where Auburn Drive High School was locked down twice this week because of fighting. On Tuesday, multiple brawls broke out in the halls and parking lot. Teachers couldn't quell the fighting, and the RCMP had to be called in. Jack Julian of CBC Radio's Information Morning in Halifax spoke to a student and her mother about what happened. Grade 11 student Emma Pratt says she thinks students need more information during a crisis.
Our teacher, who was supposed to be in the classroom with us, was upstairs helping sort out the brawls and stuff. So we were kind of, like, there were other, like, substitute teachers and stuff downstairs. So they were monitoring the halls, and they told us to stay in our classrooms and stuff until they knew what was going on. And then eventually, about 15 minutes later, our teacher came back down. He was just trying to calm us down. He turned the TV on, and we just hung out in the classroom for a bit.
How were you feeling at that point?
I was really confused because, like, I'm kind of still scared because, like, I didn't know what was going on, and they weren't really allowed to discuss what was happening. So I didn't really know what to think because you don't know what's going on outside and upstairs. And, like, people are getting hurt and getting abused and stuff, and you're just downstairs and you can't do anything and you don't know what's going on, and you're in the same building, and you just, it just makes for kind of a weird situation, just being downstairs in a room and you don't know what's happening around you and you're not allowed out. So
how were your classmates reacting?
A few of them were kind of scared. I don't know, we tried to all like calm ourselves down and stuff, and we like gave each other hugs if we needed it, and we just, I don't know, they were, some were cool about it, and the other ones, like, who knew people in the fight were really worked up and really excited about it. And
how do you think the teachers and the administration could have handled it better?
Handled it better? I think they could have at least, like, I don't know, shared with us, like, what was going on, and just let us know that things were under control, and I don't know, just talk to us about the situation, because I find, like, if you talk about the situation more, like, you get more calm, and you can talk about whatever it is you're feeling, so it just makes you feel a little bit better if you talk about it.
Now, today's Wednesday. What happened at school today?
I didn't stay at school very long. I got there, and there was no one there, and it was, like, a ghost school, and you could tell the teachers, like, some of the teachers were really scared about what was happening, and, like, one of my teachers, they were just, go home before it gets any worse, like, insisting that I go home, and just, it was really awkward around the school.
Did you talk to your teachers at all about what had happened yesterday?
No, they weren't allowed to discuss the matter with us. They were told not to. It was school policy or something. That they weren't allowed to discuss, like, the violence and stuff. So.
How are you feeling now?
I'm okay. I kind of feel a little sketchy about going back to school and stuff, but I don't know, I think in time it'll be okay, and, like, it'll eventually calm down. Either that, or they'll just keep fighting, and it'll just keep getting worse.
Thanks a lot.
Anytime.
Emma Pratt is in grade 11 at Auburn Drive High School in Coal Harbor. Emma's mother, Dorothy Boudreau, thinks school administrators have handled security well, but are failing to communicate with students.
I think it was isolating and leaving them to feel as they're like little bunnies in a cage set aside. I can't imagine anybody in any environment, whether, you know, you were someone shopping at a particular store or at your workplace or somewhere where you recreate, being treated that way upon, you know, a crisis situation occurring in that facility. We should all pause to think about what we would have done in their situation, just being left in a classroom with a door locked for sometimes hours at a time over a situation they've seen get worse and worse over almost a week now, and not be, you know, unasked questions and of teachers to be told, we're not allowed to talk about that. We've been told not to allow you to talk about it either.
What do you think the school should have done today?
The school needed to not have classes today and sort of make a break from the escalation that's occurred since, you know, sometime late last week to today, and then put some concerted effort into starting off again tomorrow with a big opportunity for the children to go in and talk about their own personal experiences, how they feel as a group, you know, just being made to feel as though that this has been an experience they've had as well, not just one that the administration had, whereby they made all the choices and the students were just recipients of whatever they did. It needed to be far more interactive. And so a break today and a start off tomorrow as a learning experience to what has happened over the last few days. I mean, they could have gone into school every morning this week with announcements that included things like, as a population, you behaved really well yesterday. Thank you, everybody, for your cooperation. And instead, they were presented with announcements as to what was being served in the lunchroom and no mention of this each and every day. So today was going to be just another day. Today, no school. Tomorrow, start off, and we're all going to learn together what has gone on over the last few days. That's what they could have done today.
Are you going to call the school or call the school board or take any action from here?
I have called the school with two suggestions. One, that the policy or protocol be changed with regard to the lockdown, that it include the students being told once they're in the classrooms and safe with the door locked that, you know, that they will be, You know, someone will be by or someone will announce to you at 15-minute intervals how things are progressing or not. And then, you know, some opportunity when this is all over for us all to get together and talk about how we think this turned out. And, you know, the school to have got some suggestions from the students as to what it is they might have done. They're missing the opportunity to learn a lot from these young people. They know the people. They know maybe more about what's going on for students who have had problems.
Is there anything else you'd like to say?
No. I guess there is. I would like to know that the school understands that all of these experiences are opportunities for us all to learn more and for the things to get better. This is my oldest child at Auburn now, or my youngest child. My oldest child went to Cole Harbor High during the rough years there. He's 30 now. And I would like to think that we learn from the experiences, but in some cases I'm not sure I see that we've learned, and I'd like the school board to be part of the growth and the students to be part of the growth and this community to learn better how to interact with one another and solve problems.
Dorothy Boudreau is the mother of a grade 11 student at Auburn Drive High School in Cole Harbor, Nova Scotia. Principal Bernie McEachern told CBC News later in the week that his staff did the best they could to quell the violence. 6 years ago, CBC Radio on Prince Edward Island conducted a test. It sent young people out to buy scratch tickets from 10 randomly selected stores on PEI. A 15-year-old was able to buy at 8 stores, and a 17-year-old at all 10. At the time, the Atlantic Lottery Corporation said that was unacceptable. The corporation has not suspended any retailer's license for selling to minors in the 6 years since then. Just last week, Atlantic Lotto sent out a reminder to parents not to put lottery tickets into their children's stockings. But it seems that it's retailers who need a reminder not to sell tickets to kids. CBC Radio conducted its test again. Pat Martell has the story.
This time, we decided to send our underage mystery shoppers, with their parents' permission, of course, to 20 stores in Charlottetown, Stratford, and Cornwall. Our first test was on a Friday morning a few weeks ago, when kids had the day off. So let's hop in the car and meet our first young mystery shopper.
Sam Stewart, Charlottetown.
How old are you, Sam?
14.
We're going to visit 20 stores, give you $20 there, and go in and see which places will sell you a lottery ticket. You're supposed to be 18, so we have to do that 20 times.
Sounds good to me. Yeah.
Are you a little bit nervous?
A little bit.
Why?
Fear of rejection.
Yeah, well, that's actually a good thing if they reject you.
Yeah.
Because they're not supposed to be selling to a 14-year-old, but we'll see whether some do or some don't. Okay, so let's get going.
See you later.
The first place Sam stopped by was a lottery outlet in a mall. The clerk there turned him down. I talked to her afterwards.
How are you?
Good.
I'm with CBC Radio. I know a young fellow just came to try and buy the lottery ticket from you, and you said no.
Is that good? Did I pass some sort of test?
Yes, you did.
Oh, great.
So why did you say no?
Asked him for ID, and he didn't have any.
How old do you think he was?
16, 17.
He was 14.
14, really? He looks older than he is.
So congratulations.
Well, thank you. Do I win a prize or anything?
No, you probably get to keep your job.
Yeah, really.
Sam was turned down at the next place, a pharmacy, as well as 7 more establishments, including convenience stores, another pharmacy, and a big grocery store. And then... Sam, what do you got there?
A lucky 7 scratch ticket.
You got one.
Yes, sir. I went in and she just gave me one. She seemed kind of suspicious, but I don't think she cared too much.
Okay, well, I'll go in and have a chat. Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm Pat Martell with CBC Radio. Just sent a young fella in who bought a scratch 7 lottery ticket from you.
Yeah.
You know how old he is?
No.
14.
He's 14?
Yeah.
Oh. I didn't know that.
How do you feel that you did sell it to him?
Not too good. I'm going to ask for ID next time.
Did they give you much training about lottery tickets?
Just that you have to be 18 and just how to work the machine.
And what do you got there?
another ticket. I asked for one. She told me it was a dollar. Passed her a toonie. She gave me the ticket and a loonie.
Okay, so let's sum up Sam's day. Remember, he's only 14, but he was able to buy at 3 out of 20 places. Our next underage shopper was Jace Wickers. I turned on my tape recorder after we visited a handful of stores. So, Jace, how's it going?
Good.
How old are you?
16.
And when was your birthday?
November 16th.
Okay, Jace, so far we visited 8 retailers. Now, I'm going to try something different here, Jace. What I want to do is play a noise, this noise, if there is a sale to you.
Oh, yeah.
And this noise if you're turned down.
Good.
So that sounds fun, Jace. So let's tally the results so far after you visited 8 places.
Oh, well.
6 of them have sold you tickets. What do you think?
I don't know. I thought they'd be a lot more strict than this, because it's all everywhere. You need to be 18 to buy lottery tickets, and I guess not.
Jeff manages a convenience store. He was watching in the back room when his clerk sold to our 14-year-old a few weeks ago. And when I spoke to him at that time, he said he would talk to his staff about the importance of not selling to minors. Well, we thought we'd go back a second time to see if Jeff's chat with employees made a difference. And this time around, Jeff's establishment was one of the few that didn't sell.
We sat down with all the staff and went over the thing. We put a little reminder up by the cash register saying, you know, if you're going to ID someone for tobacco, ID them for lottery as well. So I think the staff kind of took it to heart. And like I said, hopefully that'll be the last time.
Because if you are caught by Atlantic Lotto, you could lose your license to sell lottery tickets.
Yeah, for sure. With any convenience store, I think the main revenue that comes into your location as far as a convenience store is tobacco and lottery. So that's something we definitely don't want to have to lose for a week or 2 weeks or whatever the penalty may be.
So what percent do you think lottery would make up of?
Lottery out of our store sales, probably not including gas, I'd say anywhere from 20 to 25% probably.
On just lottery?
Just on lottery, yeah.
Wow. You don't want to mess around with that, I
No,
guess.
You don't. No, for sure. For sure.
So, Jace, just about halfway through. Let's see what happens next. So, that makes 14 out of 20 places we visited that sold you a ticket.
That's pretty good.
Not good for Atlantic Lotto.
Yeah.
For Island Morning, I'm Pat Martell in Charlottetown.
You've been listening to the Maritimes This Week, the best of CBC radio programming from the East Coast. This show is only available by internet download or podcast. All CBC podcasts are available from cbc.ca/podcast. If you'd like to comment on anything you've heard, go to cbc.ca and click on Contact Us. I'm Mike Crawley in St. John, New Brunswick. Thanks for joining me. I hope you'll listen again next week.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.